This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
For our weekly election series, If You Can Keep It, we leave the horse race and the polls to the side. Instead, we focus on the stakes of this election for people, for the country, and for our democracy. That said, we can't have a democracy without people, a country, which is sitting right here on Earth. Yes, this very large globe we're on together right now, and many of you may be celebrating it for Earth Day. Throughout this election season, we've asked you what's sending you to the ballot box. So far, your responses suggest that climate is your third most dominant concern after Trump and democracy. Here's some of what you told us.
I think that both Biden and Trump are a disaster for this climate crisis we're dealing with. I hope that we have more options than the two people who are not going to be moving us in the direction we need to go in.
I vote for the environment. The problem is that it's very difficult to vote at the higher level for pro-environment because there's so much politicking going on. I focus at the local level and work as hard as I can at that level to promote the environment.
Thanks for those messages. So today we're taking a closer look at how each presumptive nominee for the 2024 presidential election is talking about climate and energy policy. I'm Jen White with 1A's Todd Zwillick in studio, and you're listening to the 1A podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. We've got a lot to get into, so stay with us.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Carvana. On a mission to make car buying more convenient and affordable than ever before, in minutes, you can browse thousands of options under $20,000. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to get started.
Hey, I hear you have a birthday coming up. Yeah, you. If you're listening to this, that means you have a birthday coming up eventually. And here at Life Kit, we want it to be a special one.
Magic can happen and good luck can happen and serendipity can happen if we're open to it.
How to have a good birthday, even if you're not a birthday person. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
Now let's welcome someone who can help walk us through what we're hearing about climate and energy ahead of the 2024 election. Amy Harder is executive editor at Cypher News. That's an organization that covers climate and climate technology. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
So both presidential nominees have a record we can look back on when it comes to their climate and energy policy. So let's start with President Biden. The Inflation Reduction Act is the largest U.S. climate investment in history. What kind of effect has it had?
It is having a very large effect. Before I talk about the effect, I want to briefly say that although the Inflation Reduction Act is the largest climate bill in U.S. history, as you noted, most voters appear to be unaware of it. That's what a lot of the polling that I've read shows, that people don't know about it, whether they like it or don't like it. They just don't know it exists. And part of the challenge there is because it's called the Inflation Reduction Act, which, of course, was named that for the moment that it passed. But it is a little bit confusing to people who may not be watching or listening to the news very often. They hear something like the Inflation Reduction Act, and they don't think of climate. So I think that's an important foundational thing to say. But putting that aside, you know, there's some $400 billion at least of tax credits in that law, but there's really no cap. So it could be into the trillions. And then that could unlock additional private sector investment in everything from electric cars to heat pumps to more novel technologies like hydrogen and these other areas that will hopefully over years and decades move our economy to cleaner sources of energy. But it's taken, you know, that law passed in August 2022, and it's taken, you know, the last couple of years to write all of the wonky guidelines and tax rules that consumers who want to buy electric cars need. And so it's been a little bit slow going. I think with more time, more voters will become aware of it, but it's certainly been a learning challenge.
Well, Amy, how much of the IRA relies on state implementation?
A lot. And so that you've seen, for example, in the electric vehicle charging infrastructure, the Biden administration has doled out a lot of money, and it's been a very small ratio of the states that have actually built new charging infrastructure. And that's a key challenge in the electric vehicle space. In addition to high upfront costs, you also have range anxiety. And so if people don't think they can get to point A to point B, then they're not going to buy an electric car. And so that really varies widely across the country. You know, California, other Western states like Washington have done a pretty good job of having enough electric vehicle charging stations, but other parts of the country have not. And so that's been a key challenge. And I think a lot of these things you will see develop at different levels depending on where you are in the country. And sometimes that falls down on partisan lines. Maybe a Republican state may not move as aggressively as a blue state. But I will note that some red states, such as Georgia, is really becoming a hub for electric vehicle manufacturing. So although perhaps at the national level in Washington, D.C., you see climate fall on partisan lines, I think it's a much more nuanced conversation when you look across the country.
Amy, you mentioned that voters just really don't know much about the huge investments in the IRA. Just real quickly, how much of the benefit goes to individuals, like my individual tax credit or the incentive I can get for a solar panel? When I was looking down the list of all the things in the IRA, so much of it is top-level clean energy tax credits for power plants and for clean energy production. That doesn't have anything to do with, you know, directly the people who live on my street, of course. So how much of it goes directly to individuals?
That's one of the biggest challenges we face with an issue as massive as climate change. A lot of the solutions do, for better or worse, transcend the average consumer. It's changing the types of electricity, the types of energy sources that provide our electricity. But we, as the average consumer, we turn on our light just like we do any other day. The two major tax credits that apply to individual people, two that I'll mention, of course, is electric vehicle tax credits and tax credits to get heat pumps. So you can perhaps swap out a natural gas furnace for a heat pump. Now, the name heat pump is a little bit disingenuous. It's actually a device that can both heat and cool your home with electricity. And there has been some concerns about the efficacy of heat pumps in extremely cold climates. That technology is rapidly improving, so it can be used in all types of climate. Other tax credits for a rooftop solar is another example. But really, a large chunk of the law does go to these other less understandable things like hydrogen. For example, no individual person will probably be interacting with hydrogen anytime soon. But hydrogen is important to clean up things like heavy-duty trucking and maybe things like steel making and cement, which, again, are not things that we think about. But if you think in terms of, say, your vehicle, whether it's an internal combustion engine car or electric vehicle, steel is what makes your car. So that's one way to interact with it. And then, of course, cement is something we all use, whether we drive on it or walk on it. But it's definitely a couple of dots disconnected. And that's part of the challenge with an issue like climate change.
We'll talk more about Biden's record in a bit, but let's hear what Trump shared with Fox Business host Stuart Varney about climate in March 2022.
Is the climate changing because of human activity?
In my opinion, you have a thing called weather, and you go up and you go down. If you look into the 1920s, they were talking about global freezing. Okay, in other words, the globe was going to freeze. And then they go global warming. Then they couldn't use that because the temperatures were actually quite cool and many different things. So now they just talk about climate change. The climate's always been changing.
Just to be clear, weather refers to short-term changes in the atmosphere. Climate refers to atmospheric changes over long periods of time and in specific regions.
Amy, that statement is nonsensical from Donald Trump. So instead of his statements, we should talk about his record. He was president for 4 years. What was the record on climate change?
Well, he really repealed virtually everything that he could that the prior president, President Obama, had issued on climate change. I think that the biggest, most high-profile one was withdrawing the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement. And so really, he sowed a lot of confusion and doubt and did slow down efforts on climate change in the 4 years he was president. You also saw, in response to that, a record amount of concern and donations to environmental groups. I hadn't covered climate change all that much until Trump became president. And that's when corporate America, for example, started to speak up and say, hey, climate change is a real problem. And they sort of, corporate America in general, sort of responded to Trump's rhetoric on this. And so it'll be interesting to see if Trump wins again, if you see that type of groundswell support for action on climate change. Now, that said, a lot has happened since Trump was president. And so it'll be interesting to see how much that type of rhetoric that we just heard actually affects the debate. Other things that Trump did while in office, there was a lot of confusion and delay over offshore wind, which is something that we may see again. Offshore wind has hit a lot of challenges aside from politics, like high interest rates and supply chain problems. So that, if Trump wins again, that will be a key area that I'll be watching to see the impact he could have. And then, of course, on the other side of the ledger, the fossil fuel side, he really did all he could to make oil and gas drilling easier. The irony, because oil and gas drilling and things like that don't operate in presidential cycles, the United States is actually producing the most oil and gas ever in history right now under President Biden. And Biden talks about that somewhat, but he also, you know, wants to talk about the urgency of addressing climate change. So it can be a little bit awkward for him. So I think if Trump wins again, we'll see, as much as he can, loosening the regulations on oil and gas as well.
You mentioned that the United States is producing, under Joe Biden, record fossil fuels, number one producer now. But when I read Trump's website on climate, energy policy, it's basically drill, baby, drill. That's pretty much the policy from Trump. On Biden's record, the United States is energy independent right now. Can you reconcile all of the investments in the IRA and the priority for climate change, and also the fact that the United States is drilling more fossil fuels than ever before? Where are we as a country in terms of carbon?
It is a real challenge to accept those two things that you just said as fact, but in fact, they are. We're living in this era where we have to accept a level of cognitive dissonance on climate change and our energy consumption, because it is the case that two seemingly conflicting things can be true at the same time. And so, yes, the United States is producing more oil and gas than ever, and greenhouse gas emissions globally continue to rise. However, in the United States and some other developed parts of the world, our growth is plateauing. And greenhouse gas emissions growth is actually slowing as well globally. And per capita greenhouse gas emissions have actually peaked about a decade ago. That's a fact, according to Hannah Ritchie, a data scientist who recently released a book on this topic. And that's really significant, even though you see these top line numbers that suggest, oh, hey, actually, we're not solving climate change at all. There are some points in the data that suggest we actually are. Going to how the Biden administration manages this cognitive dissonance that we're all experiencing, he tries to talk about the fact that, yes, we continue to use fossil fuels, oil, natural gas, and coal, and we need to continue some investment in this space while we transition. And that is true. I mean, the global economy is still using fossil fuels for 81% of our energy consumption. That number has hardly changed in 30 years. And that's because we've increased our energy consumption over the past 30 years. So the fact that that percentage, 81%, hasn't gone up is actually a testament to the growth of renewable energy. But to the average person on the street, when you hear that, you're like, oh, geez, we have not done anything on this issue, when in fact we have. And so I think it is a very complicated topic that any administration would have a challenge communicating to say, hey, we need some fossil fuels now, but in the long term, we're going to transition to clean energy. Now, long term for this issue is decades. Long term for a political campaign is weeks or months. And so there's a real mismatch there in terms of the timeline, in terms of politics and climate change.
Well, let's go back to our inbox and hear what some of what you shared.
I am very much for doing all we can to stop the climate changes. And I'm also concerned with all the aggression in many of the national leaders, and that all this aggression may lead to an all-out war around the world. And then for our security, we need all the oil we can produce for safety.
Kate, thanks for that message. We also heard from Tom in Massachusetts, who emails, I fear that continuing warfare will delay our best efforts to slow climate change. Every dollar spent on weapons also erases any dollars available for climate change before they can even be appropriated. Amy, really briefly, how does energy policy intersect or complicate other political issues?
Oh, it does hugely so. And Russia's invasion of Ukraine really catapulted the topic of natural gas and energy security to the forefront, particularly for Europe, but also it highlighted it for the whole world. And although there's sort of cross-cutting influences here. On the one hand, yes, I agree with your listeners that understandable focus on wars, whether it's the Russia's invasion of Ukraine or what's happening in the Middle East with Israel and Gaza, all of that does demand attention and money from world leaders. On the other hand, particularly for these conflicts like the one in Russia and Ukraine that involve energy very directly, it actually in some ways has accelerated the movement away from fossil fuels in Europe. Number one, it's moved Europe away from Russian natural gas, which is significant. And now, for example, Norway is providing Europe with most of its gas. And Norway is, although it's a big fossil fuel producer, it's also a leader on climate change. So I think in the longer term, it could actually help the development of clean energy to serve as a catalyst. But this is an issue that is very close to the Biden administration's heart on these issues. And they know that having a lot of oil and natural gas production, like what we see in the United States, is an important way to influence other parts of the country, the other parts of the world. And so the fact that the United States produces more oil than Saudi Arabia, for example, has an impact. And they're trying to both push this geopolitics on both oil and climate.
Well, let's take a quick pause here. Still ahead, how do young voters feel about how climate is being prioritized in the 2024 campaigns? More in just a moment.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
On Wildcard, the new podcast from NPR, you'll hear people like comedian Jenny Slate reflect on their lives. What is something you think about very differently today than you did 10 years ago?
Dressing, like not salad dressing. I've always loved it and I'll never stop. Dressing my body.
That's all part of the new game show Wildcard, only from NPR. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to our latest installment of If You Can Keep It. Kate emails, I found that all political persuasions strongly desire to protect the environment. They may do so for different reasons. Well, what about younger voters? Let's turn to Chris Barnard. He's the president of the American Conservation Coalition. That's an organization for the conservative climate movement. Chris, welcome to 1A.
It's great to be here.
So how much of an impact do you think climate change and climate policy will be as a voting issue this year?
Well, it's one of those interesting topics because when you look at the actual data of where people rank different issues and whether they prioritize climate versus other issues, climate doesn't actually rank very high for most people. It's about a priority for about 5% of the voting population. But there was a study recently, a couple months ago, from the University of Colorado at Boulder, and they looked at how climate as an issue played in the 2020 election. And they found a really interesting dynamic where it wasn't that it was the number one issue for most people, but if you look at the strongest predictor of independence, voting for Joe Biden over Donald Trump, they found that climate was the number one predictor for that. And so that makes you wonder, like, if it's not the top issue for people, but it's the number one predictor, why is that? And I think we're getting into a political moment where climate change increasingly acts as a heuristic for how you look at candidates. And I liken it to the issue of racism. For most people, racism isn't the top issue, but no one's going to vote for a racist. And I think we're seeing a similar dynamic with climate change.
Well, then that makes me need to ask you, Chris, you're a conservative, right? Maybe in general, I don't want to make assumptions for you. You might be Republican leaning. If climate is a huge issue for you and is a heuristic for how people vote, would you vote for Donald Trump, who as recently as 2022 still called climate a hoax and says, I hate wind and wants to reverse every pro-climate policy in the IRA? Would you vote for that candidate?
Well, first, I want to say that I believe that his denial of this issue is very problematic and something I obviously disagree with. I do want to say that we have to be careful in distinguishing between people's rhetoric on a particular issue and the things that are actually done. And you pointed out some things where you feel like Trump would have a bad record on climate if he were to become president again, or that he previously had a bad record on climate. I also believe that he did some good things that I think the Biden administration has been unwilling to do. There's a study out there that shows that actually the IRA is going to be 90% ineffective if we don't also have permitting reform, which is cutting red tape to make it easier to build clean energy projects in this country. The president who started that conversation was actually Donald Trump. In 2020 with the Energy Act, that was up until then the largest investment in clean energy innovation and technology in this country, and that was signed into law by President Trump. I'm not saying that he's perfect on this, and I think there's a lot that he has to get better on, but I think I want to kind of reject the notion that just because he said bad things on climate doesn't mean that he's actually always had bad policies, and his support for American LNG exports, for nuclear energy, for energy innovation at DOE deserves more credit than it's gotten in the past.
Amy, I want to come to you on this question of permitting and the IRA. What does your reporting show?
There has been a longstanding effort that Trump has supported as well, but it's really predated even Trump, that permitting for all types of energy, but particularly wind and solar projects and other types of clean energy projects around the country need to be easier. Transmission lines is another big one. And so there is bipartisan concern for this issue. It just hasn't risen above the noise of all the other issues that Congress is dealing with to actually get over the finish line. There's a joke, right, that every week is Infrastructure Week in Washington, and yet no week is Infrastructure Week because they haven't actually passed anything. Then the question is the solution really at the federal level? If it is, the solution will more likely than not be one that some critics say could, you know, bulldoze over local communities. And so there's actually another school of thought that the solution is hyper-local. You know, we heard from a listener earlier in the show saying that they're taking their concerns about climate locally. And I think that's great because a lot of times, for example, there's county ordinances that are shaping the future of wind and solar. So part of the reason why permitting hasn't happened is because the solutions are imperfect. And to solve these issues, you have to go to a very local level. And that makes it all that much more challenging to solve.
So, Chris, when it comes back to how you're casting your vote, and maybe you haven't made up your mind yet, how are you making that decision specifically when it comes to climate policy and how each candidate stands on that?
Yeah, I just want to quickly touch on the permitting reform point before answering that question. I think that Amy's absolutely right. Like, we need permitting reform at every single level of government, including local. But we can't kid ourselves that the number one obstacle to permitting reform at the federal level has been Democrats in recent years. And actually, while this has been an issue that has been talked about a lot for a long time, actually, Trump was the first to really start the conversation around the National Environmental Policy Act, which is one of the biggest obstacles to a genuine clean energy build-out in this country. And most Democrats are just simply unwilling to touch it. And if we don't touch it at the federal level, we can say goodbye to our clean energy future. So I just want to be very clear that, yes, both sides are talking about it, but in my opinion, one side is more serious than the other.
Well, let's pause and we'll circle back to that other question. Amy, has that been your experience in your reporting, that Democrats are the barrier to this?
I think there has been some thoughts on that. And I do agree. For example, Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii has talked a lot about this issue. And he says something like the environmental movement and Democrats have been the party of let's stop fossil fuels. That's been the tagline of the environmental movement. And now suddenly they have to be the party of, yes, we have to build things. And so I think there is that concern that Democrats are delaying things. You know, I think what they would say if they were on this call, they would say, hey, we also want to ensure we can build wind and solar and other clean energy. We just have to do it in a way that is mindful and considerate of local communities. And so how do you draw that fine line of expediting clean energy while also being mindful of local communities, including indigenous communities around the country? And so that's what they would say. But it is the case that opposition is slowing down wind and solar, and that is something that probably needs to go away if we're going to aggressively tackle climate change.
And Chris, we could probably spend a whole hour talking just about permitting, but back to that question about how you're making your decision about who to vote for, because there's a broad swath of climate policies that any given candidate could pick up as their cause. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I want to start by emphasizing that, yes, I'm a conservative. And I care deeply, genuinely about the environment and about tackling climate change. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I vote in a vacuum. Like most people, I have multiple issues that I care about. And whether that's kind of the economy and inflation or what's happening at the southern border or all kinds of other issues that impact me as a young person, climate is a big thing for me. And I have been disappointed with how Donald Trump has talked about it and how he's kind of prioritized or the lack thereof. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I will vote purely on that issue. And I think it's part of the problem of the way that we talk about climate change in this political moment is we expect it to be an all or nothing issue. But the reality is that it touches so many other issues and people have different priorities. And if we expect people to just purely blindly vote on one particular issue that they care about, we're kind of disregarding all the other things that they care about. And I don't think that we should be boxing people in that way. Of course, it'll impact the way I look at candidates. It'll impact the way a lot of independents and young people look at candidates. But I think it's an unrealistic expectation that it's the only thing that they'll vote on.
So if you're part of the conservative coalition then, Chris, and I think for sure you are, and Donald Trump were to get elected president, he disagrees with you on this. I'm just going to tell you that. I mean, his record and his rhetoric are not in line with what you're saying. How would you go about, what would be the first thing that you would do to try to influence him from within? How does his party get him to take an issue seriously that he calls a hoax and says that the answer is to repeal all clean energy tax credits and drill more carbon?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we might disagree on the ins and outs of climate science. And I think like that is something that you're right to acknowledge. I think at the same time, a lot of the solutions that my organization advocates for, whether it's cutting red tape and having permitting reform or advancing nuclear power, having an all-of-the-above energy approach, making sure that we're reshoring supply chains of critical minerals and other technologies from China, I think those are all policies that any mainstream Republican, including Donald Trump, would support. And so I think that a lot of the climate movement imposes these litmus tests of to what extent do you believe in net zero by 2050 or climate change being a climate crisis or whatever it might be. We like to pivot to solutions. Like, people have different views on the science of this issue. We might disagree with people, but let's focus on what we can actually agree on. And those are the solutions that I just mentioned that I believe will have a bigger impact on tackling climate change than a lot of the solutions actually the mainstream climate movement talks about. If we have permitting reform, that is the number one obstacle to clean energy expansion in this country. If we can have more nuclear power, that'll provide clean, affordable, reliable, abundant, clean energy for the United States. If we can export American LNG to the rest of the world, that's how we reduce global reliance on coal and strengthen our alliances. If we reshore domestic critical mineral supply chains and mine those critical minerals here in the U.S. rather than with slave labor in China, that is one of the best things we can do for the climate. I don't hear most mainstream climate activists talking about that. And so we like to talk about the solutions more than we like to talk about the rhetoric or the politics of the issue.
And we should acknowledge that the fact that the Earth is warming is accepted science. And there are lots of different perspectives on how to address it, but we should say that outright. That's Chris Barnard. He's the president of the American Conservation Coalition. Chris, thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Amy, I just want to get your thoughts about what we just heard there from Chris, especially as we're thinking about young voters and the role they're going to play in this election.
Well, certainly one comment that Chris made that I agree with is China. It will be one way that you can get Trump's sort of productive attention on climate change. And in fact, competing against China is one area where Biden and Trump probably see more eye to eye than you might think. And so the tariffs on Chinese-made solar panels, for example, is something that has continued, that started under Trump and has continued under Biden. And so competing against China will be one effective way to address climate change. But I also appreciate your comment underscoring the scientific consensus of climate change, because if a potential second Trump administration is anything like the first, we are going to be in for a lot of surprising and not anticipated rhetoric that does question the scientific consensus on climate change. And that type of words, although may not have a direct impact on policy, could definitely have an impact on our debate on it. And so I think that's important to underscore. And in terms of younger people, I think as climate change becomes increases extreme weather, you're going to see the concerns of younger people increase. Now, it is competing with other issues. And I often say, you know, if you have cancer and you're in a car crash, suddenly you have two bad things. And so climate change is something people have to contend with while also contending with all these other challenges.
Amy, I think it's important to zoom out for a moment and just briefly discuss how the U.S.'s stance on climate and energy, how it affects the rest of the world, whether the rest of the world is watching any president and the approach they take.
Hugely so. And so for decades, really, the United States was seen as a laggard and an unpredictable player in the climate geopolitical realm. The Kyoto Protocol was something the United States was never a party to because the Republican politics back then, of course, then you saw Obama agree to the Paris Climate Agreement only to see Trump then take the United States out. And there's been this seesaw of U.S. policy in this area. And so, you know, we may be in for another whipsaw of U.S. policy here if Trump does pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement again, and perhaps even other intergovernmental agencies like the WTO or the underlying United Nations organization. And so the United States really matters whether it's in these agreements or not. And for decades, the U.S. wasn't doing enough. And then suddenly it did the Inflation Reduction Act, and places like Europe are accusing the United States of being too protectionist. And so no matter what the U.S. does, it has a humongous impact, not only because of our historical influence warming the planet has been the largest, but also just in terms of the geopolitical heft that the United States carries, particularly against China. And so I think that will be a key issue in the next 4 years.
Well, that was executive editor at Cypher News, Amy Harder. Also with us today, 1A's Todd Zwillick. Amy, Todd, thanks to you both. Today's producer was Jorgelina Manarea. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.
On NPR's Throughline, We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
Why is everyone so obsessed with traditional wives or trad wives on social media? This week, we're talking about the viral videos of women making marshmallows and mozzarella from scratch, and how behind the sheen of calm kitchens and cute fits, there's some interesting pessimism about our modern world. And that's worth digging into. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.